called Soccer Talk Podcast, the only podcast that focuses on watching soccer on TV, online, and apps. In episode 103, we discuss how US soccer is still reeling from not qualifying for the World Cup. We share our thoughts on the new Sunderland documentary from Netflix. ESPN Plus goes FA Cup-tastic. MLS unveils the changes to their playoff structure. And we have a bunch of letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. My name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Kartik Krishnayar. Kartik, let's jump in. It's been a busy week of football, and of course, these next few weeks are going to get even busier. A lot of the... in some ways, I feel kind of jealous, really, of a lot of US soccer media, because essentially they've got the next couple of months off with very little work to do, so they've already... A lot of them are kind of either mailing it in or just taking a break for the holidays. For us, you and I, Kartik, this is probably our busiest time of the year. And the time of the year when there is a break, which is usually, I mean, July, August, when there's, not a lot of competitive club soccer on, there's a ton of friendlies in Miami and South Florida and the US. So it seems to be nonstop. When do you take a break, Kartik?
Well, there is a break coming up in most of the major European leagues. I know there's two exceptions, Scotland and England, but there is a bit of a break coming. Although England obviously doubles down on fixtures. So I don't know. I don't really get a chance to take a break. I mean, oftentimes I've tried to use international tournaments or international breaks as those breaks. The problem is this year with the Nations League, that gave us more to worry about during September, October, November internationals. So it's tough to find a time to take a break. And I would disagree on the American soccer media. There's a lot going on off the pitch in American soccer right now. And MLS has obviously some very strange roster rules. And there are a lot of people covering the transactions going on. And we're actually less than a month now from the MLS combine and the opening of MLS camps. So... about a month away from the opening of MLS camp. So there's still a lot going on domestically.
Yeah, to me, as kind of a neutral, this time of the year is like kind of the worst time for MLS. I mean, I have zero interest in the combine, zero interest in the draft. You know, all these moves within a closed system, really, I don't know. To me, it's really mundane and boring. But we do have a lot of soccer going on, so let's dive into that. And I'm not complaining about having no break, but it's just interesting, just in terms of things heating up in the next few weeks. FA Cup, Premier League, etc., Championship, etc. So, Kartik, from this past week, there's been a lot going on. Was there any tie or any match that you watched that stood out as your favorite?
That's a good question. I watched a lot of football. I mean, I think the Dortmund-Bremen match was very, very good. Maybe that was the best of the bunch that I saw. I was fired up about Derby Forest, but it ended up being kind of a dull match with neither side really pushing forward. So then the Mexican final, both legs underwhelmed. I have a theory about that that we can get into when we go through what we watched. So I don't know. I actually this week there wasn't anything that really stood out, but I'll say Dortmund Bremen was at least the most entertaining match.
Yeah, I'm with you there, Kartik, in terms of not a lot to talk about in terms of just pure excitement and pure entertainment. I mean, the Liga MX final, to me, it was both teams canceling each other out. So it was kind of, almost picturing Jose Mourinho's Man United, or formerly Man United, but Man United playing against a team that was Man United, kind of that same style. It just was not a good look.
Well, this is the issue. So these are two clubs that have an incredible amount of support. That's why the television rating spiked in the U.S. and I'm sure did in Mexico as well. Two Mexico City clubs. When we've had finals with clubs from Monterrey, Monterrey and Tigres, or we've had, Monterrey or and Tigres. If we've had, we've had others.
Pumas.
when we've had Pumas has been open, they're from Mexico City, but when we've had Toluca, who's from outside Mexico City in finals, we have had some really exciting, open, entertaining football. At least one of the teams would play that way. For whatever reason, these two clubs, and I'm not saying it's geographic, because as I just said, Toluca and Pumas play more openly. These two clubs opted to play very defensively and not give us the sort of open football we've become accustomed to. Now, I have to say, in Liga MX, I have to say, if you look back at the finals going all the way back to 2009 in both tournaments, so that's about 20, it's a pretty big sample size, you've generally had Tigres, Monterrey, or Toluca in maybe 14 or 15 of those 20 finals. And they've all been watchable, very watchable, highly entertaining. So maybe it was just because of the two clubs we had. However, from a television perspective, which is what we cover on this show, other than having not having Chivas in it, those are the next two clubs you would want in a final. Actually, America is probably more popular than Chivas, both here and in Mexico itself. But Cruz Azul is that third club.
Yeah, so for me, Kartik, from the past week, probably quite a lot of matches that you did, and also a lot of the listeners did too, the Liverpool-Man United match, 3-1 to Liverpool. It could have been easily, could have been 5-1 if Liverpool had put the chances away. The Arsenal-Spurs game in the League Cup, Leicester-Man City, Dusseldorf against Dortmund, Swansea against Sheffield Wednesday. That's probably one that most listeners, and yourself included, didn't see, but a win for Swansea. So on and so forth. But what stood out for me, Kartik, this past week was a new Netflix documentary, something that we teased a few weeks ago. We mentioned that was coming up. I had no idea it would be this good, though. I mean, so I started watching this on Friday, probably about 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and watched it almost nonstop all the way through till probably about 12 hours later on Saturday, taking a break, of course, to go to sleep. But this was a really, really well done documentary series, starting off pre-season for the 2017-18 season, and just going through the entire season. And this was incredible, Kartik. It's hard to put it into words in terms of how good it was, but there's so many different aspects of this. But to me, what was the most important thing to me, what stood out to me, this series said a lot about absentee owners, and this one being Sunderland's former owner now, Ellis Short, and what happens to a club when the owner decides not to invest any more money. And it's devastating what happens, and we see it in the interviews with the staff, everything that happens, where it's obvious that Ellis Short says, okay, I'm done. I'm not putting any more money into this club. And I'm going to try and find a buyer, and I'm out. And then we see what happens on and off the pitch.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think also what made this very different is that there were lots of attempts. And again, it's easier to do it in eight parts than maybe in three parts, like the Watford Crystal Palace and West Brom documentaries we saw on NBCSN. And in the kind of three-part installments of the Juventus first team that we saw are also on Netflix. That was a Netflix original series, much like this. A building of the community aspect of the club, a building of the culture around supporting the football club, and a real effort to tell a story of what kind of place Sunderland is, and how this football club and support of this football club reflects that community. The Crystal Palace documentaries that Goalhanger Films did that were on NBCSN, they brushed through what it meant in Croydon, South London, but didn't really get into it. Same thing with West Brom. It was because those were shorter, and if I remember, those were half an hour each, so about an hour and a half total. This was 7 hours total, maybe 8 hours total. So very, very different. This is something the Manchester City documentary on Amazon could have done, given that they had six or eight parts. I can't remember. But I, even as a City supporter, was forcing myself to watch that. I was pushing myself through it, fast-forwarding portions. Whereas this, I binge-watched, Chris, and now have thought, you know what, I'm going to have to watch it again real soon. And the only other documentary about a football club that's done that to me is the QPR documentary on the four-year plan, which is now somewhat dated. 2011 it came out, or late 2011, but it was a very, very good look at a club trying to push into the Premier League. I think there's some very good films on Copa 90, by the way, about particularly Spanish and Italian clubs and German clubs that are very good, but again are short and don't necessarily get into as much as this did. So this is a keeper. This is near the top or at the top of club-related soccer documentaries that I've seen. So hats off to Netflix. They outdid themselves this time.
This is one I would watch again, Kartik, and that's my kind of test or sign of whether something's good enough. And this is something I might watch, I mean, in the summertime, you mean, if it's still on Netflix by that point, but in the future to watch it again. The thing that surprised me a lot, Kartik, was just the amount of animosity, frustration, just tension that was within the Sunderland ranks as far as the supporters. I guess in a way I'm not surprised in terms of just years and years of just misspending in the transfer windows. You mean, and just really abject performances a lot by a lot of the players that seemed to really not give much of a try. But in the first game in preseason, they play Celtic, and I won't tell the listeners everything that happens. But from that first game, you could sense, you could feel the tension within the supporters' ranks towards Sunderland, the football club, and the players. And from the first game, they were on the backs of those players. And I'm sure that's part of it, too, as far as the players feeling that and feeling the pressure just for a preseason friendly, and that kind of carried into the season and got worse and worse as time went on. But there's nothing bad I can say about this series, Kartik. It was that good. It was really, really good. And whether you're a Newcastle United supporter or a fan of any club in the world, this one is one to watch for sure.
Yeah, I think the other series that I really liked is the Salford City series, but that's just different, and that's personality driven. A lot of it's around the Neville brothers, which is perfectly fine, and I think gives it a compelling storyline for a lot of people who may not be interested in what is now a fifth division club. It started as an eighth division club when they bought it, a seventh or eighth division. I can't remember. I think eighth. But this is just a keeper, and I'm hopeful that we see more of this from Netflix because the Juventus first team was a little bit underwhelming for me. It smacked a lot of club propaganda, but then you saw club propaganda at a new level with the Manchester City on Amazon, which, by the way, I should say, just for posterity's sake, is very different than, because I got attacked by a lot of Manchester City supporters when I said this, which there's a lot of groupthink going on among City fans these days, which it's not the club I began supporting many moons ago. Supporters' culture, at least among their fans in the United States, has changed significantly. There was a documentary after the takeover called Blue Moon Rising that was commissioned by the Abu Dhabi ownership that, in a more digest form, I think it was about an hour and a half, showed a lot of what we saw in the Sunderland documentary and showed City missing the Champions League that year, finishing fifth in the Premier League and losing to Spurs late in the season and in May, if I recall correctly, May of 2010. So that had some of the aspects of this documentary in it. But when City had a second bite at the apple 8 years later to make something similarly compelling, they didn't. Mm-hmm. So just look at it that way.
One more thing, Kartik, about this documentary is that as I was watching the entire series, I kept on thinking in the back of my mind, this is something that the vast majority of Americans would never experience, which is the threat, the tension, the threat of relegation, of seeing their club getting relegated, and what it means, not to just the supporters, but, I mean, everyone throughout that club, the players, the staff, etc. And that's something that I guess in a way for a lot of Americans who support, you mean, MLS teams, and whether you're a fan of Colorado Rapids or Chicago Fire, there's no threat of relegation. So there's it's got to be a completely different feeling as far as that comfort level, knowing, okay, well, yeah, we suck this season, but there's always next season. There's always a chance to bring in some new players and start again. Versus this, where you really get to feel what it means, and not to say that relegation is a good thing, but it does provide accountability. It does offer an opportunity for clubs to go up, clubs to go down, and it's always about how well that club is run, and how those players do whether you kind of benefit from that or not. And that was something that was going on in the back of my mind as I'm watching this, going like, wow. For a lot of Americans, this is actually probably even more captivating because they get to experience what it's like to have their team go down.
Yeah, I think that that's very true because a lot of Americans have theories about relegation, and this includes people who support promotion and relegation and don't realize the implications on a club when a club gets relegated. So yep. It cuts both ways. And then the MLS fans who think it's a dated concept or a stupid concept. That they're both of those aspects of it. But there is also, I think, something that's happened unrelated to this in Major League Soccer, which is because there's no accountability and those clubs don't have to change, there's become a permanent underclass of MLS clubs as the league has gotten better and the top clubs have become more ambitious. And you've had the Atlantas and the Seattles and the Torontos pushing the envelope. The difference is if you're a supporter of a club that gets relegated, and you're experiencing this now with Swansea, although you guys may not pop back up, but West Brom is the perfect example. I was on TalkSport the other day to talk about West Brom and this West Brom effect, which is they struggle in the Premier League, but every time they're in the Championship, they either get promoted or they make it back to the playoffs, and they're this quintessential yo-yo club. But as a supporter, you get to experience victories and you get to experience good football. And I can speak to this as a Manchester City supporter. Now things have changed since the takeover, but a lot of us were talking in 2005, 2006, 2007, when Stuart Pearce was running the club and we were playing football that made that Liga MX final looked very progressive. That was how bad Manchester City were in that period to watch, even though we were staying in the Premier League every year because we were playing that way. Thinking, you know, it might be good to get relegated and watch some good football again and win some matches and not be trying to gut out nil-nil draws constantly. So there is also that side of it. When you get relegated, you get to experience the jubilation of victories, unless you're Sunderland, right? And you go down successive years, or Wolves went down successive years a few years ago. But then Wolves have now worked their way back into the Premier League, and they're actually a top half club at this point. Takeover in the middle of that, but still,
And in previous podcasts, Kartik, I think we've had this conversation on air about Sunderland. Maybe this is off air, but in terms of Sunderland going down was a good thing because that's an opportunity for that club to then really go ahead and, you know, wipe the slate clean, get rid of those excess players on high wages and rebuild and then come back bigger, better and stronger. But what we didn't know, perhaps, or what we do know now from this documentary series in terms of how tied they were to these different players. And the perfect example, Kartik, someone you know so well, Jack Rodwell. And this story, and he's interviewed, well, a very short interview, doesn't say much in this series, but just an example of Jack Rodwell, which is everything that's wrong with professional soccer these days. It was mind-blowing. I mean, an individual like this, seeing the club going down in financial stress, need financial money, and Jack Rodwell decides to stay with the club rather than to leave and then give Sunderland a financial boost.
One thing that was not mentioned in this documentary, which is controversial, speaking of players who came from Manchester City, it still casts a shadow over Sunderland today, is when Adam Johnson pled guilty to the charges that have thrown behind bars. Sunderland publicly had defended him with the chief executive of the club and other executives seemingly knowing he was going to plead guilty, but needing him to play in a relegation fight. He played in the relegation fight. He played well and then pled guilty at the start of the next season or somewhere in the next season, which was, I believe, the season. Maybe they still stayed up that year, but they got relegated the next year. But right. A lot of the executives at Sunderland, there was a focus on the one executive whose name is blanking out
Martin
now.
Been there
since 2010. But there were a number of other executives who had to leave the club because of that that scandal. And so that scandal was never mentioned in the documentary. That's the only critique I have of it. Otherwise, it was fantastic. They didn't have. I guess it would have been very difficult to review the Sunderland fall from the Premier League and then still make this as compelling in 8 episodes. They didn't have. They didn't have 30 episodes to do it. Right, they had 8 episodes.
Right,
but
I think the timelines wouldn't have matched up. But also, I mean, to me, it was perfect. It was going in right into just preseason, starting off and starting it from the story from there. Because to go back. I mean, you can make two or three films on the last few years of Sunderland in terms of everything that's happened at that club. But yeah, good point, Kartik, in terms of other things that were happening too that were not mentioned. But yeah, so listeners, if you get a chance, if you have Netflix or just get a free trial of Netflix, it's worth watching for that alone. All right, Kartik, speaking of Major League Soccer and talking about relegation and the threat of no relegation, let's move on to the TV streaming news and the first item.
Yeah, so Major League Soccer is going to adopt a new playoff structure for 2019. The season is going to start on March 2nd, although I've heard reports or seen reports that it's going to start even earlier in subsequent seasons and end on November 10th. This is a different playoff structure. I tend to like it. I know you disagree with me. I think it's going to put more emphasis on the regular season. There are going to be more teams in the playoffs, which I think is also a good thing because what we've had, and this goes back to not having promotion and relegation. My preference would be to have promotion and relegation. But what has happened with MLS recently is with 6 to 8 teams, or even more than that, because it seems like playoff spots have been clinched early these last few years, 6 to 8 to 10 teams qualifying, being out of playoff contention early on, Chris, there has been nothing at stake for those teams and no pressure on those players. Then there's been no real advantage to home field advantage or having home field or having the better record in the MLS Cup playoffs unless you are going for the supporter shield. Jesse Marsh, one of my favorite American coaches, now an assistant at RB Leipzig, who, by the way, I watched a few times this week on Fox. Jesse Marsh had a team that won the Supporters' Shield 1 year, won the Eastern Conference in, another year, so they were the number one seed two straight years in the Eastern Conference. They didn't make the MLS Cup final either year, and he offhandedly joked, said, you know, maybe I should finish sixth next time. Maybe I should tank the regular season. That way we get the first legs at home throughout the postseason, and we end up in MLS Cup. Because what has happened with the two-leg tie is it's actually this sounds crazy, but we saw it again with Atlanta and Portland, the two lower-seeded teams winning the first leg at home, or in Portland's case, not winning the first leg at home, but then you know, being able to use the away goals rule to their advantage in the second leg and play on the break. And it's gotten teams that are not as good into MLS Cup. I think now there's an emphasis on you're either – there's one leg, you've got to have the better record to have a home match. And the thing that I do worry about is that teams will play defensively with the one leg, the lower-seeded teams, which is why I would even – throw in there, maybe you dispense with penalties, and you give, if there's a draw, you allow the higher seeded team to advance. As crazy as that sounds, they do that in Mexico, or they've done that in Mexico in the past, and in Argentina and some other places. But just ways to make the regular season more meaningful and promote attacking football.
Yeah, so so with this one, Kartik, I actually think that the one leg playoff matches are good, and rather than having two legs, you mean everyone's going to tune in to that game. From a TV spectacle, it's good because anything can happen in that game, and it's, you know, at the end of that match it's going to be over and moving on, almost like a League Cup tie. You mean, you know, that if it goes to penalty kicks, okay, it's going to be, you'll figure out if Man City goes through against Leicester and it's done and dusted, and they move on to the next side. What I have the issue with is that for the regular season, that you got 58% of the teams are going to qualify for the playoffs, which makes the regular season practically meaningless, because, you know, you can start off slow, maybe by mid-season, pick up some results, and then maybe in the last couple of weeks of the season get a string of wins and qualify. And to me, that's kind of essentially just a really meaningless season. I mean what's the incentive to watch a team when you know that there's almost a 60% chance that they're going to make the playoffs? To me, tune into the playoffs and watch the playoffs, and that's where things start to get interesting. That's where things start to mean more, because then you've got a chance to, in a kind of a cup competition, essentially have a chance to make it all the way through to the MLS Cup final.
Yeah, I tend to disagree with that. I just gave laid out why I thought that, and I think the regular season in general has been totally meaningless in Major League Soccer. This will make it more meaningful, but we won't know until next season. We have to see how the consumers respond to this.
But how does it make it more meaningful, though, Kartik?
Because if you have a higher seed, you host a playoff match. As I said earlier, Marsh went on record saying if you have the higher seed, you're at a disadvantage in the way the playoffs were structured previously. Secondly, the more team in the playoffs when you don't have relegation pressure is a good thing. I would let 20 teams in, actually, if it were up to me, because there is nothing to play for, because the regular season is meaningless when you don't have promotion and relegation. It's never going to be as meaningful as it would be if you have a relegation. So I would let 20 teams in because there's still going to be 5 to 7 teams at the end of the season who have nothing to play for, playing dead rubbers, and their players check out. And lo and behold, they may get called into the U.S. men's national team in the October international break and be rusty and lose a qualifier like they did at Trinidad and Tobago a year ago. Just real quick point, Chris, on this. The dates have been picked to try and avoid international breaks. That's been a big criticism of the MLS Cup playoffs recently, is that it spans the November international break, so MLS breaks for the international break logically. And there have been, 2 weeks between matches? I think 1 year there was like 17 days or 18 days between matches because of television. So that's an important note.
Yeah, definitely. Although it's an important note, though, Kartik, it does make you wonder, November 10th, if the MLS Cup final for 2019 is going to be on November 10th, how that matches up then with other things happening, which if the game's on a Saturday, you got college football. If it's on a Sunday, you got NFL football. So how do you – and it's going to be on ESPN, so it's going to be less number of viewers than on Big Fox. So where do you schedule that? Well, and what time do you schedule that to have people tune in? Because
they will not be able to schedule it on a Saturday, first of all. Great catch, Chris. I should have pointed that out earlier. They will not be able to schedule it on a Saturday because ESPN's bandwidth will be full with college football. And that will be the same thing with Fox once they get to Fox the following year, because Fox always has a primetime match, unless they show it on like FS2, which they're not going to do. Sunday night, you're going head-to-head with the NFL. Yeah, okay. That's a great point. So maybe that overriding point you just made, Chris, might blow up everything I said earlier, because the television rating for this might go down based solely on the date.
For sure. And also being on ESPN and not on Big Fox. I mean, it's going to go down big time.
Well, even on Big Fox the following year, because it will be up against some sort of NFL game. They will not be able on either Fox or ESPN, because of their programming commitments for the foreseeable future, be able to play this match on a Saturday, period.
Right.
At that time of the year. That's why I thought the December 9th, 10th match date, which was after college football's final week of championship games, was so strategically useful for MLS these last few years. Now, there were a few years where they went head-to-head with 1 year with the SEC championship game. David Beckham's last match in MLS went head-to-head with the SEC title game between Georgia and Alabama, and the ratings stunk. So, it's funny, because don't you think so much of what MLS does is to try and avoid scheduling conflicts with football? But this time it seems like maybe for competitive purposes, which is a good thing, from a soccer perspective, they've made this change, but it is – I don't see how it helps the television ratings. That's a great point.
Yeah, it's under the current calendar, they're in a no-win situation. I mean, there's no way that they can schedule it unless it's a weeknight. But then, ratings are going to be hurt from a weeknight match. It's just a no-win situation under the current calendar for television. Now, for a spectator, yeah, it's fine. But for an actual television, which is where it matters the most in terms of bringing new revenue in, and especially with a new TV rights deal coming up in a few years, it's going to make a big difference. All right, Kartik, let's move on. So the next news item is that ESPN Plus is going to stream every single FA Cup third round match in a historic first. This is going to happen over the weekend of January 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th in the United States. And what it means is that for the first time ever, every single one of the 32 FA Cup third round matches are going to be shown, going to be streamed live on ESPN Plus, as well as available on demand. And this is huge, because in previous years, The FA Cup third round historically has been kind of a magical time for a lot of American soccer fans who are learning about the game or getting into the game, and they see all these games from a small stadium. Maybe it's AFC Wimbledon against a bigger team, so on and so forth. But the challenge was always that, to me, that the radio experience, listening to a third round on the radio, was so much better than watching it on television, because on the radio, they would jump from place to place to place as giant killings were happening, as the suspense and tension was building. And on television, you were kind of stuck with that one match, and most of the other matches were not available on streaming or on television. So you were kind of stuck watching, say, Man United beating, I don't know, Hull City 4-0. And it wasn't much of excitement in that. But big news, and hats off to ESPN Plus for making this possible, because this is going to be, I guess in some ways, Kartik, we're going to be spoiled for choice. We're going to have 32 matches to choose from over the course of that weekend and try and pick and choose which one you're going to watch. We're all going to be all over the place.
Yeah, in fairness, Fox did not have this opportunity in previous years when they were the rights holders, because the FA did not stream that many more matches than were picked for television. So I know there's a tendency to beat up on Fox and say, oh, well, ESPN's offering something Fox didn't. Now, there's no guarantee Fox would have offered it if it had been available, but the reality is they never had the opportunity.
Absolutely. All right, Kartik, what's on the next news item?
Yeah, so Univision and BN Sports will carry the Florida Cup in the U.S. For this year, this is the fifth edition of the Florida Cup. They're down to four teams this year, but it's still some compelling teams, including Eintracht Frankfurt and Ajax, Ajax, who have been very good in Champions League, unlucky not to win their group, if anything. This marks the second year of a partnership with Facebook to stream all the matches also live in America. I've called some of these matches in the past. I've worked the competition the last 2 years. I don't think I'm going to be involved this year, but it's an interesting tournament. Actually, I've worked the tournament three straight years, because if you go back to when the Strikers were in it, I worked for Fort Lauderdale, and you and I went to Germany to see Schalke and Leverkusen play, who were both in the competition. So I've been kind of close to this tournament. It's a neat little thing in January, every January, that gives people in Florida a chance to see European and South American teams that they wouldn't normally see during the winter breaks in many of those leagues. And Rangers came last year, which was a big hit. They're not coming this year, but it's a neat competition, so check it out.
Yeah, definitely. If you're in the Orlando area, whether you live there or on holiday in January, definitely check it out. Next news item, Kartik, is that BN Sports has refiled their carriage complaints with the FCC against Comcast. Now, this was originally filed in March of 2018, and it was essentially the complaint was that Comcast was favoring NBCSN and Universo, putting them on kind of lower tier cable packages, and while making beIN Sports only available on kind of the higher end premium packages or the Spanish language packages. And they said that wasn't fair, rightly so. The FCC came back in, I think it was like in July, I believe it was, and said that the case was dismissed without prejudice. So what that means is that it was dismissed, but there wasn't enough evidence. So beIN Sports has now gone ahead and provided the evidence to the FCC and filed a carriage complaint against Comcast, and hoping that the FCC comes back and says, yes, Comcast, Universo, and beIN Sports and Espanol, and beIN Sports and NBCSN, they all carry the similar type of coverage. They all should be available on the same type of packages. And at the same time, too, I mean, beIN Sports, I'm sure, is going to argue, too, that Comcast, who owns NBC, who has the rights to the Premier League, is in direct competition with beIN Sports, who has the exclusive rights to La Liga, who is in direct competition with the Premier League, too. So it's in Comcast's best interest to try to shut down and not provide access to beIN Sports, because that's going to help their product, which is the Premier League. And we'll have to wait and see what happens in this one. But to me, with beIN Sports, they're in a no-win situation before previously. I mean, they got nothing to lose, essentially, is what I mean. So go ahead and refile that complaint and see what happens. Because if they do win that complaint, maybe they can get back onto Comcast. And if they get back onto Comcast, maybe they can get back onto DirecTV.
I've been hearing more speculation in the last few weeks, Chris, and it's educated speculation. It's not hard data or hard reporting that Bein might be able to make a go of this, just sticking on Fubo and Sling, that enough people are signing up for those services, primarily to get Bein and watch La Liga. Whatever else you get with those packages is great, I guess, right? But it's gravy for these people, that they may be able to make a go of it to get at least through this right cycle with La Liga. I'd be very surprised if La Liga re-upped with them. But again, that's an international deal. We talked about that previously on this podcast. Now, with La Liga being concerned about the United States and having a partner in relevant sports, would they go in a different direction after 2020? And actually, that negotiation will probably start very soon. That remains to be seen. But I'm here getting some anecdotal evidence that more and more people are just signing up for Fubo and Sling, because we're now however many months into the season. And to many people, I know most listeners of this podcast love the Premier League and think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. But a lot of football fans believe La Liga is a better league and a more entertaining league, and they have been unable to live without it. So maybe Bein has something going for them in that. As long as they have the La Liga rights, there is going to be pressure and a demand for their product.
Also, according to one of my sources, Bein Sports is very interested in bidding on Copa Libertadores. So those rights are up right now. Also, I believe Telemundo is interested, as well as some other Spanish language broadcasters. But if Bein Sports could acquire the rights to Copa Libertadores, that immediately overnight elevates the rights that they have. So not only would they have La Liga and Ligue 1, but Copa Libertadores is a big deal. And as we saw from that River Boca game, you mean if you get the right teams in the right finals, and you mean there's a huge amount of support for those clubs.
Okay, one quick other point, Chris, before we move on. There have been some complaints to me and some, again, anecdotal evidence the last few weeks about the lack of distribution of Fox Deportes when it came to the first leg of that River Boca final. And I think if Copa Libertadores remains on Fox Deportes, you might have similar complaints about why is DirecTV, why are Comcast, why are Dish pushing it to a second, third tier, an additional package. So not that there's going to be a carriage dispute, which Fox files, because Fox has a lot of other channels that they own that are on top tiers on those cable systems or satellite systems. But that's another thing that's come up the last few weeks, which I guess people hadn't really noticed until they wanted to watch Boca River, the first leg, and it wasn't readily available on their television because of where Fox Deportes was placed in the packages.
All right, Kartik, let's move on to the next news item.
Yeah, so a couple of disappointing numbers. The U.S. men's national team ratings have sunk 47%. Television ratings in English, I would stress, have sunk 47% in a bleak 2018 for the U.S. Soccer Federation. And U.S. women's national team viewership declines 20% in 2018 as well. One quick thing I would point out, Chris, just in the interest of fairness, there were no competitive matches for the U.S. in 2018, whereas there were, I count, 14 competitive matches, some of which ended up on Bein because of the situation with CONCACAF. But I believe that would be 11 competitive matches that ended up on FS1 or an ESPN network in 2017. So that could account for a lot of the drop. But the overriding thing is you didn't have competitive matches. Why did you have competitive matches? Because you didn't qualify for the World Cup for the first time in over 30 years. So that's a very negative thing. One quick point, because this has been pointed out to me since the article was posted. Obviously, that was English language, and there were one or two matches in there where the Spanish language number was impressive, but the majority of them it was not.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're focusing on the English language for this one. And there's really no surprise with the TV ratings. TV ratings for both the men's and women's teams going down. But the big surprise for me, Kartik, was the attendance. And we know for several years now, this has been a long time coming. This is not just 2018 U.S. crashing out of the World Cup. This has been going on for probably 2 to 3 years in terms of declining interest in the U.S. men's national team and declining attendances. So for 2018, and yes, we know that Mexico was in the World Cup, so there's even more interest in Mexico than in most years. But Mexico's average attendance was 146% greater than the U.S. men's national team in 2018 for matches that were played in the United States, in the U.S.'s own country. Mexico had 146% better attendance. The U.S. men's national team, their average attendance in 2018 was the worst since 2006, which is kind of 2006 was really kind of that year that interest in soccer just boomed. I mean, it was kind of a really and also at the same time too, in terms of television coverage, television coverage of soccer exploded at that point. More and more games, more and more leagues being shown on television. The U.S. women's national team average attendance declined by 22% in 2018. And out of the top 45 most attended soccer games on U.S. soil in 2018, out of those top 45, only one of those games was the U.S. men's national team, and that was a game against Mexico, where you can guarantee that probably 90% of the fans, or maybe 80% of the fans, were Mexicans. You look at the top 45 most attended soccer games on U.S. soil in 2018, and it's monopolized by three things. It's the Mexican national team, it's Atlanta United, and it's European clubs playing friendlies or ICC in the United States. Everything else is really, I mean, not even on the charts. So to me, Kartik, I mean, we a year ago we did a podcast called, I think, The Darkest Day in U.S. Soccer History. Right after the U.S. got knocked out of the World Cup qualifying by Trinidad and Tobago. And at that time, we predicted everything was going to change in terms of the interest in soccer. In some ways, Kartik, I don't know about you, but I didn't think that it would be this bad in terms of all the metrics that we're looking at being so bad in so many different ways.
I didn't think it would be this bad either, although, I mean, again, I think there's just been a decline in enthusiasm about the national team going back to Jurgen Klinsmann's last year. And in fact, I was told, because Klinsmann did very poorly at the Gold Cup in 2015, lost that CONCACAF Cup match to Mexico in October of 2015 in a match that I think the U.S. lost because tactically he got it wrong. Most of the time when the United States has lost through the years, there's been they've either not been good enough or there have been other factors. But the two matches that stand out as tactical nightmares were that match and then Bruce Arena against Costa Rica in Harrison in 2017 during qualifying. But there was talk at the time, well, they're not going to sack Klinsmann unless the attendance declines and revenue was down. Well, guess what? A year later, attendance was declining and revenue was down, and they sacked Klinsmann. But they were not able to turn the situation around. So this has been now 3.5 years in coming. Really, the Jamaica match, losing that match, and even just the play in that Gold Cup in 2015 was the trigger. And then the response from the U.S. Soccer Federation was to try and offset the revenue loss by increasing ticket prices, which has alienated the supporters' base even more. So this is a big problem. And look, you may disagree with me, Chris, but I Atlanta United is fantastic. What's happening with them? You know, all these Premier League matches being on television in the United States, it's great, and fan fests and all that stuff. Liga MX, fantastic numbers for that. Without the U.S. men's national team being back at the level it was at between 1999, when they made a good run in the Confederations Cup, and 2011 or 12, taking that whole decade of the explosive growth of soccer from like 2005 to 2015, really that whole period, maybe until 2015. Without the U.S. men's national team being at that level, I think you're going to see soccer's growth plateau and maybe even just stagnate and decline.
Absolutely.
So it's critical they get this right. And we have a federation right now, Chris, that isn't getting it right. They're not very transparent. They're not very open. We just had an election for – I have to bring this up. I know this is kind of off topic. We were going to have a competitive election with 10 or 12 candidates for vice president of U.S. soccer. Once a former player started making noises, a former women's player who was on the Athletes Council, Cindy Parlow-Cohn, started making noises about running the field froze. People decided they weren't going to run, and those who still wanted to run realized they couldn't win. They didn't have a path to victory, or couldn't even get the letters to qualify to be on the ballot. And she's running unopposed. So we're not even having the discussion and dialogue and debate we need to change this thing in this country.
There's a lot of people, Kartik, that blame Jurgen Klinsmann for this decline, and I think yourself included. To me, the blame is at Major League Soccer, and I think Klinsmann was right in 2014 when he came out and said that. Here's a quote from him. It says, there's nothing I can do about it, which is talking about the decline in form and the quality of play. He says, I made it clear to Clint Dempsey, his move back and Michael Bradley's move back, that it's going to be very difficult to keep the same level that they experienced at the places where they were. It's just reality. It's being honest. And he was right. In 2014, he said that all these players coming from Europe back to Major League Soccer is going to hurt the national team. And I think that's a lot of people blame Klinsmann for kind of the decline of interest and morale and kind of the interest in the U.S. and the success, really, of U.S. men's national team. But there's a direct correlation between Major League Soccer and the U.S. men's national team. There's no surprise that U.S. men's national team is doing so poorly, and it's a direct result of Major League Soccer having a lot of these players from Central America, South America come through the system, having so many teams where the quality level is spread thin, having a lot of these Americans coming from Europe back to play in Major League Soccer. And now you have some younger players now. And Garber, I think, has admitted that, it's actually a good thing to have these younger players going out to Europe and getting experience there, which is in direct contradiction to what he said a few years ago. And he had this big, huge... You mean he kind of blew up? I mean, he went crazy when Klinsmann had said these things, because he felt it was a direct attack on Major League Soccer. But to me, the reason that we're in this mess is because of Major League Soccer.
So, yes and no. Okay, I don't think you can put all the blame on one entity. I don't put all the blame on Klinsmann. What I do say is that this was happening. This was a problem. MLS was doing it for business reasons. Players were coming back to Major League Soccer for whatever reason, monetary reasons. Klinsmann, as a manager, was not tactically savvy enough to work around it. And quite honestly, was constantly in the press throwing people under the bus to deflect from his own failings. That having been said, there's no question what you just said is correct. I don't attribute it 100% of the blame. I'd say maybe it's 50% of the blame. But here's an important note. This holiday season, I should have mentioned this at the outset when you said that this is the busiest time of the year. I'm making myself even busier because I've decided to go back and watch a lot of Columbus Crew matches to get an actual feel for Greg Berhalter's tactics, Greg Berhalter's style of play as he takes over the U.S. job. I know there's been just a lot of narrative that, oh, he's a lousy coach, or, oh, he's a great coach. He's like our version of Pep Guardiola. Whatever the case, I'm watching a lot of Crew matches, Chris, and I will tell you, I'm impressed with Berhalter tactically, although I haven't written my piece or gotten my final analysis in yet. But you know what? The reason his teams are successful tactically and he has a style of play is because he's filled that roster with foreign players, particularly on the attacking end. So right. That goes back to the point that you're making, which is, you know, all the influx of players from Central America and South America and the Caribbean, and in Berhalter's case, some players from Africa, has put Americans in a position where they're not either they're comfortable, highly paid guys like Dempsey who don't have to fight for their spot, or they're not getting game time at all, young American players, because of the influx of foreign players. It's bad both ways. And then those guys, like we've seen with Haji Wright and Weston McKinney, should have mentioned that with Schalke, one of the teams I've watched this week, have had to go overseas at the age of 18 to work their way into the first team of a big German club. And they combined for a goal yesterday against Leverkusen. Schalke-Leverkusen match is a match you and I attended a few years ago, actually, in Germany. And it was great to see one American create a goal for another American. Neither of those guys played in MLS. In the case of Haji Wright, he's a guy who played in NASL and made the move and played in NPSL and made the move at 18 to during the Florida Cup, actually, in 2018 is when Schalke announced they were going to sign him, or 2016 it would have been, overseas. But that's because of what you're saying about Major League Soccer. So a lot of problems here.
Yeah, if we look back at the attendances in 2018 for the U.S. men's national team, the average attendance was roughly 24,000 people, which is in a country of, what, 300 million people. There's enough support, even during an off year, even when the U.S. men's national team isn't doing that well, you would think to be greater than 24,000 average attendance. Kartik, that's the same average attendance as the attendance for Nottingham Forest in the championship. Just goes to show kind of the level that the U.S. men's national team is at right now. A lot of complaints from the U.S. soccer fans were, well, the ticket prices are too high. Which is true. The ticket prices are too high, but that doesn't excuse, you mean, the Mexican fans and the Colombian fans and the fans from all these other countries don't seem to have as much of a problem with that. They go out and support their country. They go out and cheer for their team. So I guess in some ways you can have it both ways in terms of that. You either support the U.S. men's national team and you go out and support your country or you don't. And in the case of Mexico and the case of Colombia and Brazil and these other teams, whenever they come and play, the vast majority of those crowds or fans are from either from that country or of that country.
Well, but they have to, not the Mexican fans, but the Colombian fans and et cetera, have to buy a ticket for one or two matches in the U.S. each year. U.S. fans are expected to buy tickets for 10 or 12 matches. Secondly, and I think this, you're going to begin to see this with European friendlies too, Chris, or maybe you did begin to see it a little bit this past year. There is a fatigue of friendlies, I think, that has developed as American soccer fans have gotten more sophisticated. In 2006, the year you referenced before, everyone was excited. Manchester United came with Chelsea. I mean, I think that's absolutely
no.
There is a more sophisticated.
That's the narrative. That's the narrative.
No. That's not the narrative. That's reality.
The reality is that the attendances have never been bigger for International Champions Cup.
Every single. Why were there 19,000 people at a Man City game or whatever, 20,000 in Miami?
It was, I think about 30,000, 30,000 to 40,000 people.
The crowd didn't look like that.
I was there, Kartik. I was there. I was at 30 to 40,000 people at that crowd. But that's just one game. There's a whole host of games being played throughout the entire country.
Let me finish my point. I think a lot of American fans, and the people buying tickets might be newer fans, a lot of American fans who have watched soccer for a number of years now know the difference between a friendly and a competitive match, which is why, you know, your point about the Girona-Barcelona match, if it had come to Miami, that would have sold out, and I think there would have been a lot of enthusiasm because it's a real game. There is more sophistication about what is a friendly and what is a competitive match now than there was in 2006 among core soccer fans. So I think in general, the U.S. friendlies were probably going to decline in attendance, but the apathy...
That's not true.
I think it's absolutely true. Talk to some people, Chris. Just talk to people who are
let me just throw out some numbers at you. 71,000 people tuning in, watched Real Madrid against Juventus at FedEx Field. You had 66,000 Barcelona against Spurs at the Rose Bowl.
Do you have an average for all the matches?
It was much greater than the U.S. men's national team. It's probably 40 to 50,000, probably average.
Okay.
The narrative is, and this comes from
Chris,
a lot of...
Chris, I think you've missed my point completely.
Let me just finish. We all know, we're intelligent people. We know that when we go to these matches, and International Champions Cup showcases it as a must win match. We know, we're smart enough to know that this is a glorified friendly. But the reality is that no matter what you call it, whether it's a meaningless friendly or glorified friendly, is fans want to go out and watch their team. So whether you're a fan of Manchester City or Bayern Munich or Borussia Dortmund or Liverpool or Manchester United, you want to go out and support your team. This is an opportunity for you
clubs,
to see...
Those clubs. Okay, this is my point. You bring Real Madrid anywhere in the country, they're going to get 100,000 people. The stadium seats 100,000. Barcelona, 100,000. My point is second-tier teams from England, Germany, Europe, Latin America, when they come to the country, their attendances are not as high as they used to be. You throw Everton or Swansea or Aston Villa somewhere, they're not going to get 40,000 people like they used to. Secondly, the U.S. men's national team friendly. If you cherry pick the top teams, yeah, the support is amazing. But I would like to see a metric where all the friendlies involving European teams are average, because I think when those teams come, they're not drawing the numbers that they used to, because there's just a recognition it's a friendly, and there are only certain teams that move the needle in the U.S. It's like 14 teams. So that's my point. The point is, in general, I think fans have gotten more sophisticated. They know the difference between friendlies and non-friendlies, and particularly with the U.S. men's national team, they have gotten conditioned to realizing friendlies are meaningless, because guess what? The U.S. has won an awful lot of meaningless friendlies, winning in Italy, winning in Germany, winning in Holland, winning, all these different places, and then it didn't translate to anything. So I think, in general, the American fan is more jaded about buying tickets for friendlies. This all having been said, we can argue this till we're blue in the face. There is an apathy problem, and the U.S. Soccer Federation isn't doing anything to solve it. I mean, the question is, Chris, this is the overriding question, and you can give me an answer. Do they really think, the elites who run the federation, that simply getting the hosting rights to the 2026 World Cup solves all of these problems, because that's the way they're acting.
They believe it.
They're behaving like that is the nirvana, that is the catch-all, that is solves everything. So who cares about any of these other issues?
Right.
They're pretending like it's 1985 and no one has any access to the sport in this country. And boom, you're going to bring this event here and it's going to be everything is going to be solved. They don't realize now in 2018 we have been through cycles where the U.S. has been pretty good, pretty competitive at the international level. I mean, as much as you and I talk about England, I have to point out the U.S. finished ahead of England in both the 2010 and 2014 World Cup. So we've seen some heights. And now you've got a fan base that's more sophisticated, more in tune to global football. They can't be conned and snowed as easily. I guess that's my overriding point about the friendlies. They can't be conned.
They're not being conned, Kartik. The numbers prove that.
Chris, this is not about European friendlies. Okay, I'm sorry I got off topic with that. This is about the U.S. Soccer Federation. So
So
they can't get conned in terms of, okay, this is an important match, or, oh, we're making progress towards our ultimate goal of winning the World Cup in whatever year. At one time it was 2010. That didn't happen. But the U.S. was competitive internationally in 2010. Mm-hmm. They didn't win the World Cup, but they were a competitive national side, and a national side that opposition generally did not want to play. I wouldn't say they feared the U.S., but they were weary of them. What we have now is a cycle where the United States is in decline. The fans know it. The fans have been sophisticated enough and been around enough now that they've recognized what the difference between a successful or partially successful national team at the international level looks like and then what they've been handed now. And the U.S. Soccer Federation's retort to all of this is, hey, we're hosting the 2026 World Cup and it will spawn a new generation of this, that, and the other thing for the national program and for soccer in this country. And the supporters aren't buying that. So the question is, the next couple of years, are we able to shift this narrative to talk about the fact that the 2026 World Cup won't make that much of a difference because the U.S. was already at a certain – it's not like 94 where the U.S. had nothing, no infrastructure, nothing. 2026, we're already at this pretty established level, or we were in 2015, 2016. We're now in decline. That it won't make that much of a difference, and so we have to do A, B, C, D, E, F, G to fix it. That's the big question, and I think that's the conversation no one wants to have at the Federation. They want to talk about hosting the 2026 World Cup. I don't think it's meaningful at this point.
At the end of the day, people will basically – I mean, the ticket numbers will show the interest. So fans are showing the interest. And we've seen for the U.S. men's national team, and it's not been just 2018. It's probably going as far back as probably 2016, a decline where the attendances have been lower year after year after year. And going back to and the USSF doesn't care because USSF is all focused on and Major League Soccer joined at the hip is all focused on the business metrics, which is revenue, which is bringing in as much money as possible, doing the deals with Nike, doing the deals with Fox and ESPN and Univision, doing all these business deals that they have. That's what they're focused on. And from that perspective, that's what they're looking at. They're not looking at the average fan or kind of declining interest.
So let me just
finish. People are voting with their feet. And for all the bad things that you say about, these glorified friendlies or these con jobs or all these different things that are happening for these European clubs or clubs from around the world coming over.
I wasn't referring to European clubs when I said
European clubs.
I was referring to the U.S. Soccer Federation conning. It has nothing to do with European clubs. So don't be so sensitive about it.
What I'm saying is that those numbers, people are voting with their feet and actually going to the games. And those numbers are as high as they've ever been. So, the narrative is, and a lot of this comes from MLS reporters, where they just completely ignore the ICC or completely ignore any teams coming from Europe or anywhere around the world to come play games in the United States. They completely ignore it as if it doesn't happen. And you can look at the most attended games. You can look at all the metrics from the ICC and other types of teams. As a whole, those are much, much greater than they used to be. Yes, if you have your Fulhams and West Ham Uniteds, they're not going to get 40,000 fans, but they still get decent numbers.
I think actually you're incorrect on that. I think 5 years ago it was a problem. More and more people, there are some exceptions. There are some that still won't cover the ICC, but I think more and more people acknowledge it exists now and cover it among what you would call, quote, MLS-centric media. Last point, Chris, maybe the solution is you start boycotting U.S. soccer sponsors. I'm just throwing that out there. I don't want to see that happen because I want to see this federation be successful and this national team be successful and see something change. But you just mentioned their focus on the commercial deals. You're absolutely right. That's the takeaway. Okay, that's, we had a 20-minute discussion or whatever on all this other stuff. That's the takeaway. They're focused on re-upping with Nike, re-upping with their other commercial sponsorships that come through some. The rest of the sponsorships are negotiated by some. The Nike deals directly by the federation. Maybe you put pressure, maybe not boycott U.S. soccer sponsors, because again, we want U.S. soccer to be successful. Maybe what you do is you put pressure on those sponsors, making it clear that you're not happy with the direction of the U.S. men's and women's national team programs. Yeah, and Chris, we might be having this conversation 3 years from now on this podcast about the women's team being in decline. So this isn't just relative to the men's game. The women's game, the results continue to be good at the senior national team level, but we're seeing signs of cracks at the youth national team levels. And that was the first sign with the men's national team. Some of us, myself included, chose to ignore it. Well, I didn't completely ignore it, but that the U-20s and the U-17s weren't as successful as they had previously been around 2010, 2012, 2014, and then that seeped into the men's national team. Same thing might happen with the women.
Yeah, and if I'm a Nike or if I'm a Fox or Univision or ESPN, I'm looking at the metrics going that there's a problem right now with the U.S. men's national team, more so. If you're Nike, you're looking at 2018, and I'm sure they lost millions on the potential of all these shirt sales. I'm sure Fox and Univision and ESPN are looking at the numbers in terms of the U.S. men's national team and the declining TV audience, as well as the attendances at these games. So the sponsors are definitely going to be tougher, I think, on U.S. soccer and on some in the deals that come up. And they're going to put more and more pressure on the U.S. men's national team to perform and to actually qualify, win the Gold Cup, qualify for the World Cup. And I don't know. It's going to be rough. It's going to be a rough few years. And we'll have to wait and see what happens.
And to my overall point earlier, not my overall point, but my earlier point about Greg Berhalter, Chris, I'll leave this discussion on this. I like what I see from watching a lot of Columbus. I also note that it was mostly done with foreign players, at least in the attacking end. So Berhalter may have a system. He might have a style. He may have personal preferences for how he wants the U.S. to play. I'm not sure American players are at the level right now to implement his style. Mm-hmm. So we might have more hard times. And if the U.S. does not win the Gold Cup, I think that's the metric. If they don't win the Gold Cup, we're going to have more problems. We're going to have a conversation like this times two in 6 months or whenever the Gold Cup ends in July.
Right. Yeah, and I think everyone's kind of thinking that qualification for the 2022 World Cup is a guarantee that's going to happen. But unless FIFA does change the number of teams and move it up to 48 for 2022, which they're talking about, the U.S. could find themselves not qualifying. They could find themselves, kind of fourth-ranked or fifth-ranked in CONCACAF, depending on what happens. Right, one last more news item, Kartik, before we move on, and that's a real quick one, and that's ESPN2 has lost their number two position among sports networks in the United States for the first time in 25 years. So for the last 25 years, it had always been that ESPN was number one, ESPN2 was number two in the amount of viewers, etc., that watched the sports networks. Now ESPN is still number one. Number two is NBCSN. Number three is FS1. And then number four is ESPN2. So a big hit to ESPN2, but big gains there for NBCSN and for FS1. And two reasons for that, Kartik. Well, actually, one reason is soccer. I mean, NBCSN with the Premier League and, of course, Fox, FS1 with the World Cup. That's had a big impact on those numbers.
Yeah, although, again, ESPN2, I guess, shows a fair amount of soccer. There's just decline with ESPN. Now, Chris, this is the time, I guess, to mention, and I'll just mention this in passing, that a lot of people complain about the size of their cable bill, right? People, you've cut the cord, but people who haven't cut the cord. So much of that is due to ESPN that I think people are cutting cable. If they had the option of a la carte cable and they could just pull ESPN and ESPN2 out of their cable bill, they might keep cable. Just another topic to throw out there.
All right, let's move on to TV ratings. A big one this past week, and that was the Liga MX Apertura final, two legs. The two legs combined was 4.8 million people that tuned in to watch Club America win against Cruz Azul. That was matches on the Thursday and then the second leg on the Sunday across Univision and Univision Deportes Network. So massive numbers there for Liga MX, and congratulations to Univision. Some other big numbers, 1.15 million people tuned in to watch Liverpool against Man United on Sunday. This game was on NBCSN and Telemundo, the final game for Jose Mourinho in that one. And any other numbers, Kartik, that jump out?
Yeah, I think both the Liverpool-Man United number was really high for a Sunday morning match on on NBCSN, and it was also on Telemundo, as you mentioned. The Fulham-West Ham number is low for an NBC match. Now, I was watching, actually, Dortmund at the same time against Werder Bremen on FS2, I believe it was on. I can't even remember now. Maybe it was on FS1. But that was low, and the other number was high, which I don't know what to make of that, because generally you don't see NBCSN matches with that many more viewers than NBC matches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and part of it too, unfortunately, Fulham just looking pretty dire this season, so not a lot of which in previous years that would have been probably a big number with the Fulham America, that would have been a big deal, but these days Fulham not so good to watch, at least not now. Moving on to listener mailbag, John Average Geek says, I think Atlanta being a dominant club is good, like DC United at the beginning of MLS. If one team sets a bar, everyone has to up their game. Chris Hardy says, hello, I'm an American and somewhat new to soccer, been off and on for a while, but I'm getting back into it. I read on Wikipedia that the Capital One Cup, now the Carabao Cup, wasn't important to big clubs or a priority or something like that, so that's why they arrest their star players. Is this true? Can you explain this to me? I don't get it. I thought every match was huge. Shouldn't they be? I know it's Wikipedia, but that line bothered me. Kartik, what do you think about this?
Being a Man City fan. It's generally true. I mean, unfortunately, you see a lot of squad rotation. The Carabao Cup, you have to remember, it's different than the FA Cup in that it's a midweek. The matches are midweek fixtures. So they're usually squeezed between Premier League rounds, always squeezed between Premier League rounds, and sometimes in a period of a lot of fixture congestion with Europe, et cetera, for the big clubs. You even saw it yesterday with the Arsenal-Spurs match. There was intensity from the players, but I felt like the crowd intensity wasn't what it was when those two sides faced each other at the Emirates 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago in the league. There's just United played City in Pep's first season. It was the first Pep Mourinho matchup, or maybe the second Pep Mourinho matchup in the Premier League, and it didn't have the intensity. I remember one year when Liverpool played United, you would think that would be huge in the then Capital One Cup, and it didn't have the intensity. My only explanation, Chris, is it's midweek. Managers rotate. But what we've seen also is a lot of smaller teams rotate too, because there's always something going on. This is the thing, I guess, the mistake that a lot of folks make. There are teams pushing for promotion from the championship who have to get through a 46-match gauntlet to get to the Premier League, to get promoted. The top teams in the championship, I've seen do more to kind of throw cup matches than even the top Premier League sides, where they're just rotating completely. You'll see it in the FA Cup third round with the teams chasing promotion to the Premier League. So unfortunately, that's where cup football is in England.
Yeah, that answers that question pretty well. And it's one of those things that clubs have to prioritize, or managers have to prioritize the importance of different competitions. And Champions League usually is number one, number two is the Premier League, number three is probably the League Cup and FA Cup combined, depending on where that club is and what round they're in. But they just have to figure out a way to prioritize the competitions that are going to generate the most amount of revenue for their club at the end of the day, and a greater chance of silverware. Toby Schumacher says, am I reading this right? And the MLS Cup is moving to Sunday against the NFL and possibly NASCAR? no way would TV partners be happy to allow this move from a relatively barren sports day that was starting to get some traction. November 12th, Atlanta versus NYCFC got all of 285,000 viewers on ESPN. The only way this might work is to move it to ABC in primetime. Would get killed by Sunday Night Football, but even America's Funniest Home Videos gets 4 million on ABC on Sunday night. Maybe that's the plan. Get 3 to 4 million and have MLS write breathless press releases. High fives all around. And Jason Ryder says, this is the last comment here on the listener mailbag. I have a question for the podcast. Have you noticed the contrasts between Netflix's Sunderland Till I Die and Amazon Prime's Man City's All or Nothing? There are contrasts in the results on the pitch, the transfer dealings, and the overall competency of management and players. Also, very noticeable are the facilities and dressing rooms that you see in the background. Would love to hear your thoughts in comparing and contrasting the two series with each other. And Kartik, you've done this a little bit already. I still haven't seen the All or Nothing series from Amazon on Man City, but any other comparisons or contrast between the two documentaries or the two clubs?
Yeah, I guess you do see the contrast between a really well-structured club with incredible facilities and spending a lot of money, and then that, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, Chris, absentee owner that's not spending much money. That having been said, as I think I put on Twitter and got all this backlash, which I mentioned earlier in the show, the Manchester City series on Amazon Prime is essentially club propaganda. It's essentially everything is highly sanitized. From where I sit, whereas the Sunderland documentary, it wasn't. I'm not giving Netflix credit vis-a-vis Amazon because we had a previous Netflix documentary on Juventus, which was highly sanitized as well, much like the Manchester City documentary. And I've seen Amazon Prime do some very good things as well. So it's just these two, this specific example. But I think part of the contrast you see is because Sunderland allowed more of a no-holds-barred look at the club. And at the community and at the city, whereas Manchester City seems to have tightly scripted what Amazon could do and what the producers could do a little more tightly. So I think it's difficult to draw conclusions because I just think the overall editorial tone of the two documentaries is completely different. And I know there's going to be Manchester City fans for that. So I'm prepared. We might have a mailbag full of it next week, Chris.
Yeah, definitely. All right, listeners, if you do have any questions or any feedback or you want some advice, you agree or disagree with anything we've said, you can always reach us via email through web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always post your comments on worldsoccertalk.com. We'd love to get your feedback. It's really kind of the engine that drives this show, and we love getting questions from you, the listeners, so definitely let us know. So, Kartik, in closing, thank you, everyone, for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audio Boom, and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review on iTunes. And Kartik, going into another weekend, another big weekend, you've got Cardiff against Man United with Solskjaer coming back to be caretaker manager of Man United against his former club that he took down and got relegated, as well as plenty of other matches going on. What should they do?
And you've got 1 and 2 in the Bundesliga, by the way, on Friday to kick off the weekend. Dortmund and Gladbach. And watch that and all the Premier League and enjoy your football.